and related ideas, and I'm going to end it with a paper that I keep coming back to, and many people I know keep coming back to, which is a paper by Ted Jacobson. And I know Harvey will love this if Harvey eventually comes in. And the paper is GRPC 950404. It's also in physical legal letters somewhere about that time. And this is a far-reaching paper about the issue of thermodynamics and space-time, and the possible relation of thermodynamics and space-time and quantum gravity. And the reason for talking about this paper, besides the fact that it's a paper that really anybody who's thinking about quantum gravity, is either a physicist or a philosopher, in my opinion, should know the argument of this paper, it comes down strongly on the side of space-time and gravity being emergent. And therefore, it's a strong part of the case that space-time and gravity are emergent. And it ties right in after the discussion we've had. It's not a difficult argument to present. So that's the first part, is this argument of Ted Jacobson on space-time and thermodynamics. The title of the paper is, well, to say it, the thermodynamics of space-time, the Einstein equation of state. So that's the first part of the class. The second part of the class, I'm going to turn back to the issues that we began with, which are the issues of time, and particularly the question which I hope to convince you, if I haven't already, is closely related, which is the status, the question of what's the law of nature, what's the status of the notion of the law of nature in a cosmological context. And what I want to do is close off my part of the physics presentation. And I apologize, by the way, the class has gone a little bit back and forth, physics, philosophy, etc. But with the exception of still wanting to have a guest lecture by Raphael Sorkin about the pathological point of view, my idea is to close off the physics pedagogical part of the class by coming back to these issues of the nature of time and the nature of law, and then in the remaining few classes really focus on those issues. So that's the two parts of the class today. Okay. Any questions, comments from previous? Before we go on. Okay. And I apologize for not having sent this to you earlier, so you don't have this beautiful paper of Ted Jacobson in front of you. So it's up to me to present it beautifully. Okay. So, in this paper, Ted makes a very strong claim. And the claim he makes is the following. Suppose there exists some fundamental theory. Okay. So maybe that doesn't need to be said. That's a very assumption. Suppose that the laws of thermodynamics are true, are true in this fundamental theory, And particularly, we'll need, and this is, I believe, the first law of thermodynamics, that if I have a heat flow into or out of an isolated system, the change in the energy is the temperature times the change. The change in the energy is the temperature times the change in the entropy. Okay, so we're going to assume that. Suppose that this fundamental theory, let's call this T, T has an approximation which is quantum field theory in Minkowski spacetime. Assumption, otherwise we wouldn't be interested in this theory, most likely. And suppose, and this is the assumption with a byte, and maybe I'll give the Let me could try to say this in a cute way or sneak up on it, but let me give the context that is the precise context, and then we can generalize out. So we're used to the idea that we can construct an isolated system. And there are times we can construct, and then the laws of thermodynamics hold, there are times that we can construct an isolated system in Minkowski spacetime by virtue of the motion of an observer. So there is a context in which we can consider in Minkowski spacetime. So I now am in Minkowski spacetime, and I'll just do two dimensions. So if there's a metric x and t, and we can consider a world line xa of t, and we can consider the velocity is dxa with respect to the proper time d tau, and we know that dA is minus 1. And we can also consider in Minkowski spacetime an accelerating world line where there's a 4 vector of acceleration, d squared a xa d tau squared. And there's a relativistically invariant meaningful definition of acceleration, which is the relativistic norm, which is minus, let me call it, kappa squared. And supposing we consider the case of an observer who is accelerating uniformly away from the origin of the x-axis. And let me give myself a little room for the diagram that I'm going to draw. That looks something like that. This is the world line of an acceleration with kappa constant. And yes?
The line is minus k squared.
Oh, you're right, it's plus. Right, it's plus, thank you. It's a space line. Thank you. And in fact, it's true that a contracted with b is 0. That's right. Thank you. Good. Like other mistakes I will make, that was just designed to make sure that somebody was listening. But that actually is an important comment. Now, some people may know the context in which, forgive me for discussing the details. Such an observer, if an observer accelerates forever, defines a horizon. That is, there is a null surface that defines this, there's a point P, and that defines a null surface here such that no light from the future part of this null surface will ever reach the observer. And let's call that the future horizon. And there's another null surface, and I needed the point P. We can call it H minus, such that no light from the observer will ever cross the surface and reach the world on the other side. And in particular, there is a wedge here, this region here, that no information from this wedge will reach the observer and vice versa. And because of that, the observer defines, the motion of the observer defines an isolated system. Now, I think I actually want the other two directions, dy squared plus dz squared. I'm not sure what that, make a call, dial a number, call now. Are you guys okay over there?
Fine, I'm asking.
Okay, and I don't think anybody's in Guelph, or at least nobody's indicated to me. Okay.
We just had a brief view of Guelph.
We just had, was anybody there?
Didn't look like it.
Okay. Okay. Now, supposing, now, we can consider that this isolated system is defined by this horizon here, and that the horizon forms a boundary to the isolated system defined by the motion of the observer. And the idea is, what we're going to do is we're going to see if the laws of thermodynamics apply to these kinds of isolated systems. That is, we're going to define a dq, a T, and a dS, and see if the laws of thermodynamics apply. And the key last assumption is the following. There is perpendicular, that is, in the YZ plane, an element of area which defines the boundary. And we can think of it as a little space-like two-surface put here. And the assumption that we're going to make is that in this context, so in that context of that diagram, that if we have some heat flow across the boundary, delta Q going across the boundary, that results in a change of entropy, that change of entropy will be represented by a change in the area, that is, the change in the entropy due to the heat flow will be the change in the area over 4G H bar. And this is motivated by some version of the holographic hypothesis that we talked about before. The idea that was that the entropy of an isolated system defined by some boundary in space-time is, so far as anybody external to it is concerned, bounded by or measurable by the area of that boundary. We've created an isolated system by our motion, if we are this accelerated observer, and therefore, if the holographic hypothesis is true, the information about a system on the other side of the boundary that we have access to is related to or proportional to the area of that boundary, and therefore, if there's a change in entropy, that requires a change in the area. And so that's the governing assumption. And so this is Ted's paper. Actually, it didn't precede the holographic hypothesis, which was 1993. So I'm actually curious. Does he mention? He mentions Bekenstein's original paper relating area to entropy, and that's all, and Susskind in a talk. Okay. So he was inspired by. So this was inspired by holographic hypothesis. Now, roughly speaking, here's Ted's idea. Roughly speaking, he says, I've set up a situation where there's a boundary in space-time. It's created by the motion of the observer, but it should be as good as any other situation where I create a boundary in space-time. If I believe in the laws of thermodynamics, then I believe that when there's some heat flow, delta Q in equilibrium, a small delta Q should be related to a T ds. So this is thermodynamics. If I believe the holographic hypothesis, this should be related to T some change in area over 4G H bar. But this implies that the geometry of space-time must change. If I'm an accelerated observer, my motion sets up this situation, and some heat flows across that boundary that I defined, then this implies that the area of that boundary must change, which means that the geometry of space-time must change. Yes?
I'm a little confused about the assumption of made by the holographic principle. What if we say that that region of space is empty, has negligible entropy? Does that statement have meaning? Does that force us to give it a very small boundary?
No, the claim is that by virtue of accelerating, okay, I define an area that I have no communication with, or that has no communication with me. Therefore, that's an isolated system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Therefore, the holographic hypothesis says that the amount of information that they can have about me, or I can have about them, is proportional to the area of the boundary. Therefore, and if I buy the statistical mechanical relationship between entropy and information that implies the entropy of the system perceived by me, or my entropy perceived by them, is proportional to the entropy, which is proportional to the area. That's the assumption going in here. Okay. Now, what's about to happen is the following. We're going to do some setup, and delta A is going to turn into something proportional to some components of space-time curvature, because that indeed is what curvature measures, is changes in the geometry of space-time. Delta Q is proportional to some components of the energy-momentum tensor. Let me just state of thought. Therefore, we have a relationship between some components of the energy momentum tensor and some components of curvature. What we're going to find is the following. Those components are defined by the motion of this particular observer. But that observer is, the only thing we know about it is that they're uniformly accelerating. And remember, we're in or very close to Minkowski spacetime. So there are an infinite number of such observers uniformly accelerating in any direction from any position. So in fact, there are not just one relation between components of curvature and components of the angular momentum tensor, but an infinite number of relations. In fact, two tensors worth of relations. And so saying that this is true for any accelerated observer is going to bring a relationship between the full energy momentum tensor and the full curvature. Okay. Now, there's a bunch of constants around, and there's a temperature here, and there's a 4G, so the G can come over here where it should go. There's a temperature over H bar. There's a bunch of other constants. Of course, if the temperature is zero, then we get no relation. But it turns out there's a reason for the temperature not to be zero. And Ted argues the temperature has exactly the right value, for a reason I'll say in a moment, that this really turns out to be exactly the Einstein equations. So that the Einstein equations, according to this argument, which now I'll go into in a little more detail, are nothing but the combination of the first law of thermodynamics with the holographic hypothesis.
Second law.
Thank you.
Okay. So, the delta Q, that's supposed to be like unradiation?
No. Okay. Well, I'll come to that. This is the sketch of the argument.
Okay.
I'm going to give the actual argument.
Yeah. And you have the full Riemann tensor on the right hand side? Or
again, I'm going to give the, you'll see exactly. There's a mathematical argument to follow.
Yeah. I'm kind of confused about the delta Q. Could you please explain what is that delta Q which is inserted inside
there? I will.
Okay.
So let me stress that this argument is friendly to the idea that space-time is emergent and the Einstein equations are a consequence of that emergence. But they depend on this holographic hypothesis having a prior and a fundamental status that is even more fundamental than the Einstein equations themselves, because the notion is to derive the Einstein equations as a consequence of the relationship between entropy and area, hypothesized here to hold so strongly that when the entropy of any region of space-time changes, its area should change as well. Okay. Okay, so that's the form of this argument. So any questions, we haven't heard from any questions from Western so far with the setup? Okay, our view of you is opaque, well, translucent because we're seeing all the control panels for some reason.
And we can see fine.
We can see fine, okay.
Questions?
Does the argument run the other way? So if you started with the Einstein equations and said, well, and I'm going to start with those equations as fundamental, and then I'm going to insist on using the first law of thermodynamics, then I'm forced to the holographic identification.
In some sense, that's what got us here. That is, that path is the path that leads to Hawking radiation. Okay, and in some sense, what we're doing is we're walking backwards through the derivation of Hawking radiation. It doesn't.
So then, presumably, like, if these thermodynamic laws are giving rise to that equation, there should be some statistical mechanics version of those thermodynamic laws.
Yes.
That would be some more fundamental theory than Einstein.
Yes.
But so is the hope that through quantum gravity, by quantizing just the classical equations of motion, we can get each of that thing discovered just for.
Any number of people in loop quantum gravity, or I'm sure in string theory, or in causal sets, or in any approach to quantum gravity, have seen the hope of this as a way from the fundamental theory to the Einstein equations. And no paper has appeared running that argument through, to my knowledge. So this is one of these papers which holds out a promise of a fundamental move or development which hasn't happened. And it's very interesting to think about why that hasn't happened. I've certainly spent my time with this argument, as I'm sure you ask any of us, for teaming the wrong. The string theorists have their own versions and approaches to this. So.
Lee, can I just ask a question? The first thermodynamic equation, I'm not quite sure how to interpret it. I mean, it could be considered just a definition of delta S. Where is the meat in it?
The meat is, of course, here.
Yeah.
This is, of course, here.
So,
and everything else is talk.
Because the second law tells us that the S is in fact a parameter it's a parameter that's associated with the equilibrium state of the system,
mm-hmm.
independent of its history and the whole. So the non-trivial thing is that it's being connected with information by way of the sort of Boltzmann motion.
Yes.
Okay. And that brings in this area of thing through the holographic.
Right. And what's contemplated is that there's some bounded region of time where a certain amount, finite amount of delta Q flows once over this horizon. And we're talking about taking a little unit of area perpendicular to the horizon here, and let me say call that A1, and a little unit of area here, and call it A2, defined by the congruence of null lines that make up the horizon, and delta A is meant to be A2 minus A1, the change as a result of this bounded in time and space excursion of some heat across there, and I'll discuss it. I'll give almost all the details. I'll leave a little bit of geometry as an exercise. Now, the little bit that I've left out is the story of the temperature. And this is a crucial aspect, so let me discuss it. And I'm not going to derive it, but let me discuss how it's derived. There's a discovery of Gil Unruh from, I think, 76, inspired by the discoveries of Bekenstein and Hawking. And the discovery is the following. In the setup just described, if we give to the observer a thermometer, and we have a free quantum field, or an interacting quantum field, it doesn't matter, on Minkowski space-time, such that the field, the quantum field, in the Minkowski space-time, is in the ground state, then even though the quantum field is in the ground state, the thermometer carried by the uniformly accelerated observer will be excited, and they will measure a temperature T, which is equal to h bar times the acceleration over 2 pi times the speed of light. And that's called the under temperature. Now, let me emphasize that this has nothing to do with quantum gravity. This is Minkowski space-time, an ordinary quantum field, such as we use every day in, you know, general application in quantum electrodynamics, say. It's a well-tested area of science, although this effect is still not tested. And it's easily derived, and I'll mention two ways in which it can be derived. So there doesn't seem to be any reason to doubt this. It's once you see where it comes from, it's not a particularly revolutionary result, but it's a general prediction.
Yeah. I recall Bill mentioning in class last year that electrons in synchrotron accelerators are depolarized by under radiation.
My understanding is that that's not fact, but it's a hypothesis. I could be wrong. I know that they're, so that's my understanding. I was going to mention that. It's also not outside of existing technology to test this by using very, very high-powered lasers. And there have been proposals to do so. That is, just zap an electron, basically give it a short space of time as large an acceleration as you can. What you want to do, so what you would expect, you know, zapping an electron, you would create, so, a burst of thermal radiation, and the energy goes like the temperature to the fourth, which therefore goes like h bar times the acceleration to the fourth. There is also Bremsstrom, where the energy created goes like the acceleration squared, if I remember correctly. And it's a question of getting so much acceleration that this is measurable against the background of this. This has some, I don't remember, but I think has some power law spectrum. Is that right? Does anybody remember Bremsstrom? This has the power law spectrum. This has the thermal spectrum. It's not impossible to invent an experiment that would test that, but my understanding is it hasn't been done. I think it's been proposed at Los Alamos, where they have these incredibly high power lasers that they use for trying to get fusion. And that proposal that particles, I think it's electrons in storage rings, where they have high acceleration, may be depolarized by that. I know that proposal is around. And maybe I missed something. Maybe there's something that I don't know about.
No, that. I think Bill said pretty much what you just said.
Okay. So Let me just, in case it's of interest, let me just tell you, I mean, a good place to go to this is the textbook of Morrell and Hayes. Although the paper of Unruh is pretty clear as well. If you go looking for this, there's also a review paper of Bryce DeWitt. I think a year or two later, I think 78, reviews of modern physics. I don't have a precise reference, which has a good derivation of it. One way to do it, which is how to study this, which is how Unruh did, is Unruh invented a little two-state system with states 0 and 1, which were carried along. And he invented an interacting Hamiltonian, which was some creation operator in that little observer state space, times the field at the point where the detector is. And he just invented a little interaction Hamiltonian like that. And he computed the density matrix for the state in the little detector as a result of that coupling, and found that it's a thermal density matrix of that temperature. And it's I might have done it in front of you, but it sort of takes 15 or 20 minutes to set up, and then it's just a Fourier transform. There's an interesting alternative way to think about it, and it's very important to mention the first calculation first, because the first calculation is an ordinary calculation in ordinary quantum field theory. If you don't believe it, then there's a lot to not believe in. The second way it's often presented is a little bit more, relies on a little bit more, and that's the worst light cone I've ever seen. The second way it's presented is to consider a space-time, a region of space-time parameterized by a set of trajectories of these observers, and the space-time, we call this region 1 within this wedge here, and its metric, if I define coordinates, time coordinates tau, where this is tau equals 0, this is say tau equals 1, and some coordinate c, this region can be quantized such that the metric looks like e to ds squared is e to the kappa times c d tau squared plus d c squared, where this is the same kappa that is it is the acceleration of the observer moving along the line c equals 1. And then this region, let's call it region 2, is another region that can be so parameterized by another metric. So this is called the Rindler metric. And what we do is have Rindler region 1 and Rindler region 2. Of course, the interior of the light cone of this point is not included in region 1 or region 2. And then one can construct a quantum field theory. One then Well, let me say it in that order. One can construct a quantum field theory in the region called Rindler 1. And in particular, one can note that there is here that these world lines of constant acceleration, let me call the tangent vectors chi, that these are actually time-like Killing vectors, because chi is d by d tau, and the metric doesn't depend on tau. And so these are time-like Killing vectors. Just like the Minkowski time coordinate is a time-like Killing vector, and you can follow the procedure to construct a quantum field theory, but with respect to the time coordinates tau, rather than with respect to the time coordinates t of Minkowski space, which is to say that the distinction between phi of c and tau, between when you write it as a mode sum, and you have e to the minus I omega tau times some annihilation operator a k, and this is omega of k, plus the Hermitian conjugate, you make a decomposition into creation and annihilation operators with respect to this new Killing field. And you can only do that in Rindler region 1 because the coordinate system becomes degenerate here on this two surfaces of the horizons that define the wedge. Nonetheless, you can then define a Hilbert space of region 1, and it has a vacuum state in region 1, and you can construct particle states by creation operators, and so forth. Similarly, you can construct in region 2 the Hilbert space of region 2. Now, what you can do, is that clear so far? We have a quantum field theory in region 1, which has a vacuum state and excited states, and a quantum field theory in region 2, which has a vacuum state and excited states. Each has creation annihilation operators. And those creation annihilation operators are different. So in fact, let me give them a different symbol. Let me call these Bs. Are different than the creation annihilation operators in Minkowski space that act on the Hilbert space of Minkowski space. Now, there's a clever little thing you can do, and the clever little thing you can do is you can construct a map between the Hilbert space and Minkowski space, and the product of the Hilbert space for regions 1 and regions 2. That is, a pure state in Minkowski space is not a pure state in region 1, it's not a pure state in region 2, but it can be a pure state in the product of region 1 and region 2. Then, and this, you know, vastly preceded quantum information language, but the way you would define the next step is easy to say in quantum field theory language. You can take the density matrix for the Minkowski vacuum That is the state which is 0, 0, the Minkowski vacuum. You can define a partial trace by tracing out region 2. And what you're left with is, I'll just write in words, is the density matrix for a thermal state in region 1. And the thermal state in region 1 with the temperature unru that I wrote down here. So what that means is that all observations made by an observer in region 2 using the definition of creation annihilation operators natural for region 2 of the Minkowski vacuum state will return the values of the thermal state. That's the result. And of course, it's good. This, you could question, you could say, what am I doing quantum field theory on a restricted region of space-time? There, one might worry, is this the right way to do quantum field theory in non-Minkowskian coordinates? Can I do quantum field theory for accelerated observers? Somebody might say, well, why not? It's, you have a time-like Killing field, you have the same situation as Minkowski space, but somebody might say it's not the same situation in Minkowski space because there's a horizon that's incomplete. So you could argue about that, and people, of course, did argue about it, but the fact that you get the same answer by an ordinary quantum field theory calculation in the Minkowski space quantum field theory makes this a pretty believable prediction. It is just a prediction, but it's a prediction I think most of us who have gone through these calculations would be shocked if the experiments were done and didn't turn out. Okay? So, questions about that, about the unru temperature? Okay. Yes?
Well, the other way to derive it is the operational point of view, right? Where you take a detector and couple it to the field and see what the detector does.
Yeah.
And then you get the same answer.
Yes.
Is there something special about the fact that this derivation gives the right answer? Because it doesn't seem immediately evident.
I don't know. I mean, I agree with you. I believe it more because of the first ordinary quantum field theory calculation.
Really?
I'm agreeing with you.
Oh.
I'm agreeing with you.
Oh.
Okay. That's what I thought I was saying when I said you can just couple the detector to the
ordinary yes.
quantum field theory and accelerated. I don't know. Anyway, it's an assumption of this calculation that we're discussing. If in fact, as I emphasized, the temperature in the case that we've been discussing was T, was zero, there would be no argument. But so the step that I've argued is that what Ted Jacobson is going to do is use the unru temperature here. And just to take it one step before we fill in more details, that means there's an h bar here, which conveniently enough cancels this h bar here from the holographic hypothesis, leaving there's a 2 pi, which makes this 8 pi times Newton's constant, which is the right thing precisely to bring over to this side to be the Einstein equations. And there is this kappa, and there's a speed of light, and those will turn out to be precisely the right things which are needed when we put all the details in. Kappa, remember, is the acceleration.
So that's looking at it from the point of view of the accelerating.
Yes. We are looking at this from the point of view of the accelerator.
And if you looked at it the other way, the temperature's zero, right?
Right.
But then the observer is still isolated from the cusp, from that wedge, right?
I don't have an answer to that question. We're looking at, we're making this derivation from the point of view of the accelerated observer. Not that that's not a valid start of the discussion, but I don't know where, I don't know where it goes. Okay. Can I, let's see, what am I going to do? I think I want to make this, still have a blackboard. So let me sketch the details.
So just to follow up. Essentially just saying that the temperature is not generally covariant. It's not a scalar. Is that right?
That's a good point, yes. But again, we're looking at it from the point of view of this accelerated observer. And they, so now, if you think about it now from the point of view of this accelerated observer, they're in a situation which is static. That is, I mean, I only happen to have drawn it so that there's a surface of tau equals zero there, but there's a symmetry. So they're seeing themselves in a static situation. They see themselves in a thermal bath. Everything is static, so they conceive of themselves as in equilibrium. And then some things come across their horizon. And more particularly, there's, in reality, there's an energy momentum tensor which flows across the horizon. And I have to tell you really what I mean by delta Q. So what I mean by delta Q is that there are these time-like killing fields that I was just mentioning. Let me get the name right. I'm bad on Greek, on the second half of the Greek alphabet, chi A. And what I mean by delta Q is I want to integrate the energy momentum tensor of the stuff that flows into that time-like killing vector against the area of the surface that is flowing across, chi B, and that's what I mean by delta Q. Possibly, sorry. And what we're going to imagine doing is doing the integral on these time-like curves that limit into the horizon, into the null curves of the horizon. And so the technically tricky bit of the calculation that I'm going to leave as an exercise is that the horizon is generated by some null killing vector Ka. So there's a family of null vectors in this region which, when restricted to the horizon, are the generators of the horizon. There's an affine parameter such that that corresponds to d by d lambda on the horizon. And we're going to choose to normalize things so that lambda is zero there and lambda is negative going backwards into the past from there. These are just technical details. And then in the limit, so we have a null killing field in this region and a time-like killing field in this region. And in the limit that we're close to the, an approximation where we're close to the horizon, the relationship is that chi is proportional to minus lambda because lambda is negative in this region times the acceleration parameter times the null vector. And I'm going to leave this as an exercise. It's in Hawking and Ellis in their discussion of horizons. And I thought about wowing you with its two blackboard derivation, but I was afraid that I would screw up. So I believe this is an exercise, and it's a purely technical thing in general relativity and geometry. And we also need the definition of an area element. The definition of the area element is that d3 sigma a is proportional to ka. So this is a three form giving a volume element on the horizon. Its dual, which is a vector, is null because the horizon is the vector, because the horizon is in fact a null surface. So it's, when you raise the indices, it's proportional to the k. It's, then there's a d lambda integrating in the affine parameter on the horizon, and a d area integrating. D area is always just dy dz in the two flat directions perpendicular. And therefore, the expression for dq is minus the acceleration, the integral on the horizon, lambda tab ka kb integrated d lambda the area. And that's the general relativistic expression for the heat that flows across the horizon into our hot isolated system. Okay, questions?
How natural is that? How natural is that first formula? I mean, why would you think of, if you look at that integral, why would you think of it as speed?
It's energy flowing. It is, in fact, the energy that flows across the surface. It's I mean, why is it not just the KK component, or?
No.
So the idea is, this is not, as Sean asked, part of the unreal radiation. May or may not be, quote, real. The idea is, the observer sees themselves as in equilibrium at the unreal temperature. Then there's an incursion. Something enters their system. Afterwards, they see themselves as, or they see themselves as in equilibrium again at the same temperature, but a little bit of energy has flown in. So it's natural to think of that as heat which has entered the system.
But that doesn't heat up the little detector or anything like that. That stays at the same temperature.
Yes. I mean, you would expect temporarily, as the detector whizzes by, there might sort of perturb this. I mean, we're in an idealization in which there's an infinite
right.
heat capacity, because there's an infinite space to the right of here. Were that not the case, where there's some other walls here,
but in each one of these accelerators, the observer, he carries this, he sees a constant gravitation. Not gravitational field, but he's accelerating at a constant yes. rate. Sees that, sees his detector always stays at the same temperature. You think
yes, but
say,
hey, just
no.
We're talking about a change from far in the past of this excursion to far in the future of this excursion. In the excursion, when the energy momentum tensor was not zero of this external stuff, whatever it was. There might have been some perturbation of all the detectors. But far in the future, of that, this detector settles down to the same temperature. That's the assumption. Okay. So, if there's a change in the area, what is that? Well, there's, again, you can read in Hawking and Ellis or from Eric, and if Eric has treated black holes, I'm sure he's done the following. There is the expansion of the null rays on the horizon. Expansion of the null generators that is on the horizon, and the change in the area of the horizon is the integral over the horizon of that expansion integrated the lambda over the time, that's the affine parameter on the horizon, and integrated dA. So that's the other side of the equation. How do we compute beta? We refer to the Ray Chowdhury equations, which are just equations from differential geometry about congruences of geodesics. In the case of null geodesics, it tells us that d theta d lambda, defined where everything's defined as we have so far, is minus the curvature, the Ricci curvature, RAPKAKB, minus 1/2 the expansion squared, minus sigma squared the shear. That's just an equation from geometry. There's no physics in that equation. That's an equation from differential geometry. And you can find that again in Walt or in Hawking Ellis, or again, I'm sure in Aaron's course.
But what is this theta?
Theta is, I have a congruence of null geodesics which define a horizon. They define a surface, a little element of area, and theta is the change in area. Like you can, this is not, it's normally its definition, but you can take this as a definition, and this is a consequence of the definition.
So what is the last letter for the theta?
Sigma.
What is that?
That's the shear. That's relevant. I mean, there, I can write down the definitions of all these things, but I won't bother because that's zero in this case. That's if the null geodesics are shearing past each other. So this is zero. We're in going to approximate this in a case where theta is a small parameter. And so we're going to approximate that as zero, and we're going to integrate and come to the conclusion that theta is the integral. If I integrate both sides, I'm integrating d lambda, assuming that nothing changes very much in lambda. So this is the integral of d lambda of R e d k a k d with a minus sign. And assuming that lambda is zero there, and we're integrating from some negative lambda where the shear is zero up to lambda of zero, this we can approximate by just minus lambda R e d k a k d. And all quantities are small because we're controlling, the governing thing which is controlling everything is the amount of TAB, and we can make this as small as we like, so as to keep the consequences of that flow, of the consequences small. So we do that. Therefore, delta A is approximated by minus the integral of lambda RAD KA KB d lambda dA. Putting this value for theta into here. Okay. Questions?
Is there also, am I right in thinking that there's a vorticity term that's also put to zero?
The vorticity, I think, yes. Yeah. I think it's never there for null, if I remember correctly. Something for red is never there for null.
Okay. Yes, if we are in Gauss space-time, why the tensor is not zero? And the energy momentum tensor should be the expectation value of the quantum field, right?
No. Good. So two good points. Let me take them in opposite order. Okay. The assumption is that this stuff that's flowing in is not the quantum field that is excited to a temperature T from the point of view of the observer. It's some classical fluid stuff, not quantum mechanical. That's the assumption of the argument. And I'm going to make the argument, Ted makes the argument to make the argument do what he wants. And what he wants is to derive the classical Einstein equations. So this is classical energy momentum due to some real classical stuff. Okay. The second, yes, I started out saying we weren't in the constant space-time. So now let me say something slightly more different. Something different than I should have emphasized before. Okay. We're now in a curved space-time where there is an accelerated observer, and where I can assume that the acceleration, let me see how I want to say this. The acceleration defines a distance which is related to 1 over kappa, which is the actual distance to the horizon. So if I accelerate, there's some horizon behind me. As long as I'm accelerating uniformly, the horizon stays at a fixed distance behind me. That is, in my time coordinate, I go from this surface of simultaneity to that surface of simultaneity to that surface of simultaneity, and I'm staying at a c equals constant. So my distance to the horizon is my coordinate c. It doesn't look like on this space-time diagram, but these all have the same interval, the same space-time
so
interval.
So it's like an observing the gravitational field of the Earth.
Yes. Now, the assumption of this discussion is that that distance to the horizon for this accelerated observer is very small compared to any radius of curvature. Okay? And so by the equivalence principle, I'm able to argue that I can use quantum field theory in Minkowski space-time to first order to predict the effects that I would see. And you're quite right, thanks, I should have said this. It's an important thing to say because we are in the course of deriving the Einstein equations which govern a curved space-time. Okay. So maybe I should put that back. As an approximation, let me put that back in the assumption of quantum field theory in Minkowski space-time. Okay. Let me put a note here. And the note says, I don't know where I want to put it, for an accelerated observer, for the distance to the horizon, 1 over kappa, be much smaller then the radius of curvature. So now we might consider that the derivation is wrong because we're making an assumption about how far we can trust flat space quantum field theory.
Yeah. Does that mean that when you define constant acceleration, in general relativity, what area that would mean, a constant acceleration with respect to a local inertia frame?
Yes, it means
but
that.
But here, that condition is telling us that we don't have to worry too much about this notion of a local inertia frame. Is that right?
Well,
but
it means...
As big as
it means the inertial frame has to be at least much bigger than the distance to my horizon that I create by my acceleration. So if there are effects that have to do with curvature on the quantum field, they're of higher order. That's the assumption. An interesting question is if the Einstein equations were not known and they were derived through this process, whether we would believe them. Okay, but
can't you always just make caps as big as you want?
Yes. 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 That's the assumption. Okay, so now I need just a little bit of blackboard space to clean up the consequences of everything. I think I'll just use this. So now if I combine it, now I'm just put the pieces together. And the pieces tell me that minus kappa times the interval of the horizon of Ka, Kb, times lambda, times d lambda, times d area. Let me just put it all together. All this stuff here is common to both expressions. So I get here kappa times Tab. And that's equal to TdS T is, so I'm just going to put a minus sign here. I'm going to set all of this equal to zero. T, as we said before, is h bar times kappa the acceleration over 2 pi c times delta A, and delta A, what was right here, is the same kappa A, kappa B, d lambda, d A, lambda, times R A B over H bar G times 4. That's the holographic 1 over 4 times the Poincaré. The h-bars cancel. Very interesting that the h-bars cancel because that means I get a relation that has nothing to do with quantum mechanics. The kappas are the same, which is why it was very important that the temperature is the unruh temperature. And I am left with the assertion that Ka, Kb times 8 pi G Tab minus Rab is equal to zero. Now, that has to be true. We invented the situation by inventing the accelerated observer. So that has to be true for every null vector, which could be the generator of the horizon for some accelerated observer. Consequently, 8 pi g Tab is equal to Rab plus some arbitrary function times the metric. Why? Because the metric times Ka, Kb is zero, because the horizon is a null surface. It's not difficult to show that what you can have here is you can have minus a half GAB times R. This is covariantly conserved, and this is covariantly conserved. So the only thing that the function can be is a constant times GAB. And so consequently, one arrives at the Einstein equations with an arbitrary cosmological constant.
How do you know the TIB is conserved? Because
by assumption.
By assumption.
By assumption. So let me write that assumption down. Okay, that's Ted Jacobson's argument.
That's cool.
And let me just try to review its assumptions and then talk for a couple of minutes about at least one take on its consequences. And now let's take a break and then we'll come back. So what did I assume in this, besides some differential geometry, a little piece of differential geometry that I left as an exercise about null and Hilbert fields? We assume that there's some fundamental theory that has an approximation in terms of quantum field theory on manifolds, on metric spacetimes, Lorentzian spacetimes, such that we could assume that for regions small compared to the radius of curvature, we could use the equivalence principle quantum mechanically and assert that an accelerated observer within that region sees what an accelerated observer in Minkowski space would see in the Minkowski vacuum. So that's a long sentence, but that's the heart of what we assumed. It's some kind of version of a correspondence principle, that there's a limit which is quantum field theory in Minkowski space-time, and there's a much more interesting approximation which has curved space-times, but where nonetheless, if we look at regions much smaller than the radius of curvature, we can not only for classical physics approximate things as if they were in flat space-time, that's the equivalence principle, but a kind of quantum extension of it, we can behave as if we're in the Minkowski vacuum as would be seen by some purely quantum observer. And that's to assume a lot. There's not nothing in here. And of course, that's why the famous paper deriving this from loop quantum gravity or string theory or something like that hasn't happened yet, because that's a lot that you have to get out of your fundamental theory. It doesn't get you away from having to get quantum field theory in Minkowski space from some approximation to the theory and from having to get some somewhat quantum mechanical version of the equivalence principle. And I'm going to come back and critique that part in a minute. Okay? Then we assumed the second law of thermodynamics. And we assumed a version of the holographic hypothesis relevant for this context, which is that accelerated observers define isolated systems or regions hidden from them whose thermodynamic entropy they could associate with the area of the boundary. And that's all. And then they did a calculation in quantum field theory and a calculation in classical general relativity. They contemplated some classical fluid of energy and momentum flowing across their past horizon into their region, and computed the consequences and discovered some components of the Einstein equations. And then they argued that that has to be true for every so situated accelerated observer in the space-time. And they found that that could only be the case if the space-time curvature was related to that classical energy momentum tensor by the Einstein equations. With, and it snuck in at the last minute, an undetermined value of the cosmological constant. And let me just close by stressing, it would be a really different conversation if this had not come out. Because it's very interesting that that came out.
Okay,
you have a question?
Yeah, how do you, given the setup, how do you know that it's the energy momentum tensor of every possible material system?
We don't. Okay. I think we don't. Maybe I'm responding too quickly. I'm not aware of an argument that says let there be an arbitrary energy momentum tensor, and then you can always construct a scenario with the accelerated observer design. It certainly requires that the region where the energy momentum tensor is non-zero is bounded in a certain way, so that there's a static region before it and a static region on the other side of it, and so forth.
If the TAB could be, say, an electromagnetic field or something like that, right? It could be a completely determined, well-defined function of time, some packet of electromagnetic radiation that's coming across. I wouldn't normally associate that with heat. Yeah. I mean, that's a well-defined electromagnetic field. I could think about black body radiation, and I would associate it with temperature, and I would consider the energy flow of black body radiation as heat. But a well-defined wave, a little wave packet out of somebody's laser to identify that as heat seems a bit curious.
Could I support that? Just another observation. One of the striking things about this is, as you say, it's not that as in ordinary general relativity where the conservation of time follows from the field equations. Here, the form of the field equations follows from the conservation of time and
Yes.
Now, heat is not conserved in this way. I mean, there is a sort of a disanalogy here. In thermodynamics, you wouldn't expect heat to be conserved because it can be transferred into work. Total energy is conserved, but not heat. So there's a sort of a disanalogy here, I think.
Okay. I don't have a that's the work. More questions? Western comments, questions? Okay, I see that as a head shaking now. So I want to think about that. The break. I think if you accept that the terms of the argument, and maybe one should, but if you accept the argument, it tells you that the Einstein equations, at least in the context contemplated, descend from the equations of thermodynamics of some other system, or could be so regarded as descending from thermodynamics of some other system. So long as that the thermodynamics has of that system has the property that area, when a surface serves as a boundary, in at least a case like this, of an isolated system, the area is a measure of its thermodynamic entropy. Now, that's a strong hypothesis. That's the hypothesis of the holographic principle. I motivated it. It's certainly not been derived from anything. One, you know, perhaps the strongest version of it is the Busso derivation, which we gave in the last one, in the last lecture, because that showed it is closely tied, at least the form of it is closely tied to the Einstein equations. The hope has been expressed that the holographic hypothesis is not just a hypothesis about a property of general relativity coupled to quantum fields, which is how it appears in the Busso derivation, but is a principle which could be used to found a theory. That is a principle like the equivalence principle, or like the principle of uncertainty or the relativity of inertial frames, which could be used to found a physical theory. And this is a kind of example of how it would function in such a theory to lead to general relativity. Now, if it were so, you should say it that way, then there are sort of two things which are readily apparent. And let me say these and then get your reaction on stage break. One is that it would be really dumb to quantize the Einstein equations, because the Einstein equations are appearing as cases of the laws of thermodynamics. Question two, when it comes to questions like the nature of time, one should not take general relativity too strongly. That is, one should not look for definitive answers in general relativity. One should look for constraints within general relativity, but one should look for definitive answers in whatever theory this is that is pointed to. Because that theory is a theory where space-time does not exist fundamentally, and then the issue of whether time exists fundamentally, whether time is emergent, and so forth, is a discussion about the role of time in that theory. Okay, so I want to pause there. Well, I'm happy to take a few comments, and then I think we need to make a small comment.
Very small comment. This seems to me to be evidence that, as you say, general relativity is very closely tied to the assumption of a manifold.
Yes.
And I don't mean that in a trivial way so much as in the sense that if you have physics on a manifold, you have to get something like general relativity out. So your comment that we don't want to be quantizing general relativity could be extended to say, if we want a quantum theory of gravity, as we expect we do, it can't live on a manifold. It has to be some other space structure.
Well, let's say it need not.
Mm-hmm.
At the very the minimal statement is it need not. I mean, this what I've been describing is a program, but from the point of view of this result, now maybe this result is based on faulty reasoning, but from the point of view of this result, it would seem as strange to arrive at that more fundamental description of nature by quantizing the Einstein equations as it would, you know, to us to arrive at it by quantizing the laws of thermodynamics. Okay, Sean, quick comment.
It seems like this derivation seems to make sort of string theory seem a bit more natural. This is that it's you're just getting the Einstein equations in some limit or something versus quantizing the Einstein equation, which is a
Yeah, so this supports the hypothesis, and you know, whether it's through string theory or something else, it supports the hypothesis that the fundamental theory is not in the language of general relativity. And general relativity is a phenomenological description of that more fundamental.
Very quick.
Okay.
Here you have a lot of assumption, and then you have a lot of approximation, and then you have it in like the way definition of the energy of volume, and at the end we get the anxious equations. So can it be like kind of play with the equations to get this equation at the end? Because
well, let me make the following suggestion. I mean, the suggestion that John and Harvey made that the laws of thermodynamics are being misused here, I have not thought about it, not heard. So I think we should think about it.
Yeah.
This paper, in my opinion, okay, this paper bears thinking about slowly. There's a lot packed in. In the journal, it's a 4-page paper, meaning that it's a six-page paper essentially in the preprint. There's a lot packed in there, and it bears thought. And one comes, I find anyway, and I know other people feel the same way. I come back to it the way that people come back to a favorite poem that they learned at some point. It's not that by taking a slightly different turn somewhere, he could have arrived somewhere different. At least I haven't found that. And there's a small literature about this paper which tries various detours and ins and outs and examines it in somewhat different contexts. I don't want to push it too strongly either, because it could be that our fascination with this is based on some misplaced idea. But it's not a cheap trick. I mean, once you understand the logic of it, especially, a good thing to do is to study the original Hawking paper. I haven't done that derivation in terms of study the original Hawking paper, where one goes through the same thing about the limits of killing vectors on the horizon and so forth. The same math is in there. And then study this paper. And in a certain sense, this is a running backwards through the derivation of the Hawking paper, but not quite. Not quite, because this horizon is just established by any observer anywhere. And nobody is claiming. The unruled radiation is a property of the vacuum as seen by an accelerated observer. No one is claiming that the unruled radiation has non-zero expectation value of energy momentum. If you compute the expectation value of the energy momentum tensor, in the unruled case, it's zero, because the state is the Minkowski vacuum. This is a property of the Minkowski vacuum. So in that sense, it's different from the Hawking calculation. But it has many of the same elements.
Would it be fair to say that the energy that the detector seems to be picking up is provided by the means by which it's accelerated?
That's the standard thing that we like to say. Yeah.
But it's not true. That can't be right. Because you don't need to specify the way that the particle accelerates. And I seem to recall that the energy is extracted from the other Rindler wedge that you expect.
No, so question is, okay, it's a long time since I've been through this issue, so I may get this wrong, but my understanding, my memory is that if you actually go through the work of coupling to that little finite state system, which is carried along by the detector, you are accelerating that. And well, actually, it's not clear to me. I mean, when you're in equilibrium, you're in equilibrium. Let me think about that. Okay, on that note, let's take a 15-minute break, and then I'm happy to discuss this as long as people want to, but then I want to, in the light of this, bring the discussion back to the original conference.